You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome and good afternoon and welcome to Brookings. My name is Ted Pacone. I'm a senior fellow and deputy director of the Foreign Policy Program. And we're very honored to have with us an incredible panel to talk about the tragic earthquake in Haiti that took place almost exactly 1 year ago. We are here today really at a momentous time to stop back and reflect on the challenges that Haiti faces, the terrible tragedy, and to take a moment to take stock of the circumstances there and how to move forward in a best possible way for all concerned. We're going to have a full discussion, and it will proceed in the following way. We're first going to hear from our honored guest, Sean Penn, who is the founder of the JP Haitian Relief Organization, and you'll hear lots more about that as we go through. And we will then also hear from Paul Weisenfeld, who is the Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development's Bureau for Latin America and the Caribbean. They will each speak from the podium for about 10 minutes, and then we'll take some questions and answers. We will then turn to our panelists, and I will introduce them in a moment, and we will take a very brief break when Mr. Penn needs to leave around 3 o'clock, but we will then continue with the discussion until 3:30. So let me now formally introduce our panelists. Mr. Penn is a 2-time Academy Award winner, and you have their bios, so I'm not going to recount them in detail, and it's an incredibly impressive career in film, writing as a journalist, and increasingly as a humanitarian. And his work in Haiti has been particularly remarkable. He's also done some work in New Orleans after the Hurricane Katrina, but recently, he's been spending all of his time, when he's not on a film set, it seems, in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince, working side by side with the victims of the earthquake. His organization runs the largest IDP camp in Port-au-Prince and established the first emergency relocation in the country. He's worked quite closely with the U.S. military. It'll be interesting to hear his thoughts on that. Has been commended with many different awards from the U.S. military, and we're very honored to have him here. We will then hear from Paul Weisenfeld. He's had over 18 years of experience at USAID and served as the coordinator of USAID's Haiti Task Force in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake. Has a lot of field experience in countries like Peru, Zimbabwe, and Egypt, and he will give us a sense of how things look from a USAID perspective. We will take some Q&A. We'll go back to the panel, and we'll hear from Sam Worthington. Samuel Worthington is the president and CEO of Interaction, which is a partner in hosting this event. Interaction is the largest alliance of U.S.-based international non-governmental organizations with 190 members. He's also very involved in the Interagency Standing Committee at the United Nations. And I will come back and make an announcement about their work in a moment. We also have the privilege of hearing from two other speakers. Beth Ferris is the director of the Brookings Project on Internal Displacement and also a senior fellow here at Foreign Policy. She's an expert on forced migration, human rights, humanitarian action, the role of civil society. She's just returned, as many of our speakers have, from Haiti. She's spent many years in Geneva working for the World Council of Churches, teaches and writes extensively on these topics. And then we will hear from Claude Jude. Claude is the director of Habitat for Humanity Haiti, and he's been running that position since 2004. Habitat for Humanity has been in Haiti for 27 years, so they have a long-term perspective on the issues of shelter and housing on the island. He's also a member of the Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, which is the body that is co-chaired by the Prime Minister of Haiti and former President Bill Clinton that we'll also be hearing about in the course of the discussion. So, as you'll know from the press attention in this anniversary, a lot of people are asking what's going on, why aren't we seeing more progress on reconstruction? I mean, I think that the job here is to really, with these experts, is to explore some of the complexities of the situation, both of the happenings on the ground and the overall international response to it. And one question that we'll want to focus on is more than the immediate response and the logistics, but also the rights and dignity of the Haitian people involved in this disaster. And in that spirit, there is a new document that we have been here at Brookings very involved with, in particular a project on internal displacement, which is the guidelines, the operational guidelines on human rights and natural disasters. And we have copies for you out front. This document was adopted by the Interagency Standing Committee, which is a body affiliated with the United Nations and is the highest humanitarian coordination body that we have in the world. And these principles, I think, put front and center the whole range of rights that are implicated in natural disasters and how to think about them in an intelligent way. As you know from the statistics, the earthquake killed over 200,000 people, displaced 1.5 million people. The infrastructure is ruined in Port-au-Prince, capital city. You'll be hearing a lot more statistics. I will not go through them all. I think it's clear that there's very strong political will on the part of governments and the general public to help Haiti. The outpouring has been tremendous. But we're now in this window where the immediate crisis is past us, and there needs to be action on reconstruction. And this is where it really takes a long time to get moving. It's in a planning phase. You don't see as much of the progress as you'd like to see on the ground. And that situation, how long does that situation last? And where can things go wrong? What are the trade-offs to really show tangible progress for the Haitian people is one of the key questions, I think, that we'll be talking about today. So with no further ado, let me ask Sean Penn to come to the podium.
Thank you. Well, in the last days, but beginning yesterday and today, we understand that the Office of the American States is going to make a recommendation that the candidate supported by the president of Haiti, Jude Celestin, drop out of the race and that the runoff be between Michel Martelly and Manigat. Whether or not the president will accept this proposition remains to be seen, and the assumption is that an official announcement and his response and the CEP response to this will follow the anniversary and the attendant media. In either case, just to frame the circumstances of that we're talking about today and that you'll hear a lot of various perspectives on, to go back to the beginning, we had a country with a rather broken infrastructure and void of infrastructure in many ways prior to the earthquake. Government offices that close at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, an earthquake that happened at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and 60% of government buildings collapsing on those committed enough to stay after hours and killing so many of the valuable resources, human resources, and human beings in Haiti. This is to say that while so much of the attention is going to be at the slow pace of things, that the interconnectedness of a human population so severely traumatized with such a chaotic disaster as an earthquake, where infrastructure, building codes mixed so poorly and created so much damage, this in the best of circumstances would be a venture that took some enormous patience and a kind of, I think, re-education of cultural interpretation and media coverage, a patience that would be more human than commercial, and one that we should be pushing very hard to see in the coming year. When the International Donors Conference Toward a New Future for Haiti was held in March of last year, $9.9 billion was pledged over the next 3 years. Of this amount, more than $5 billion was pledged for 2010-2011. Pledges that ranged from the Senegalese offer to build a Senegal-based Haitian consulate to an IMF pledge of concession on loan and debt relief. So here we are, January 10th, 2011, and while the world media will focus on Haitian election fraud and call for re-elections and recounts, it would be worth our considering our own closet. How would it be if we were to do a redo of the donors' conference with caveats? No nation may diminish the value of their initial pledge, and no nation may pledge in-kind donation or diversified pledges. This translates into a conference which would allow the Haitian government and the Haitian people to hold donor nations' feet to the fire by requiring not cash but tangible components of reconstruction. This would look like France stating that it would rebuild 8 hospitals that were destroyed and repair and pay out debt on the 22 that were severely damaged. As a coalition, all donor nations would commit that every Haitian have access to potable water and drilled wells with filtration or desalinization units as appropriate, so that every Haitian would have access to clean water by 2012, with each nation responsible for a city and outlying area, including the mountainous and remote areas, who are at particular risk of mortality as they suffer cholera with a lack of clean water accessible. 2012 is a year for visionaries. With an already severely malnourished infrastructure, Haiti faced a devastating earthquake that killed nearly 300,000 people, 300,000 human beings in 10 seconds 1 year ago, not to mention the nearly 400,000 with largely devastating injuries. Since that time, tens of thousands have been killed from flood and mudslides. Hurricane Thomas put Port-au-Prince in the crosshairs of catastrophe for nearly a week, and a near miss, sending aid organizations into a virtual lockdown and panicking an already vulnerable population. Then the recent elections and the doubts in their legitimacy showed that though a resolutely civil society, this recent and passionate expression is synonymous with a traumatized culture finding its first voice since the most devastating disaster in human history occurred just 1 year ago. This is where it gets tricky, because as we have seen, the media will report on chaos, death, and destruction, and with our Haitian partners' burgeoning emotional readiness, and make no mistake, there is still mourning to do. The alchemy that is our culture's lack of patience, their country's immediate needs are going to be at odds, because what will potentially be newsworthy tragedy in the upcoming months of social struggle surrounding elections will be the perception of a chaotic and unsolvable set of problems at the most solvable moment. If the media and if we in the international relief community and our donors stand beside this expression of the people and stand beside the current government and whatever future government they may choose, 2012 will be the beginning of a triumph that has never been seen so tangibly on a small half-island nation of 10 million, an hour and a half from our shores. How do we do it? How do we change the failed dynamic of relief work of the last several decades? We can start by looking at the common thread of failure. I've been in Haiti since mid-January 2010. I came with a fresh eye but not without experience, as you might be surprised to note that creating and sustaining an effective NGO is not at all unlike producing a film. As I've said several times before, the stakes are immeasurably higher, but the process is nearly identical. In our NGO, JPHRO, today our burn rate is approximately $1 million a month. In film, our burn rate is about $120,000 a day, which adds up to about three times the burn rate of my NGO. The number of staff is approximately the same. Cash for work programs pay far less to the equivalent for fees of crowd scenes comprised of members of an extras union. We break it down to department heads and areas of operations. And in one case, money adds up to entertainment and, given a little care, perhaps a few provocative thoughts gifted to the culture. In the other case, in the NGO case, it adds up to the preservation of lives of men, women, and children, and with a little luck, human hope and independence. This brings me back to the threat of failed aid in Haiti and the front row seat that I have had in this past year. In film, if we fail to provoke an audience, we fail a medium that is obliged to more than entertainment, with its power to be big cultural medicine. And when we fail that, it is due to our reliance on cliché. So here is a cliché that you often hear in the NGO community. Here is a cliché that, as much as any, is as Hollywood as anything I've ever seen and should be given its final coffin nail. Don't give them fish. Teach them to fish. What fish? What school? What building inspector? What building code? What materials? Of course, we have to support Haiti with training, parallel training. But that can also be the smokescreen that teach them to fish. The smokescreen that leaves hundreds of thousands of vulnerable in unsanitary camps through next year's hurricane season. We've got to put the fish there. The time for action is now. 1 year after the earthquake, we're facing challenges with donors on issues like camp management. I'm hearing every day that more and more NGOs are relieving themselves of the role of camp manager, because the funding is drying up for those activities or because the job's just too hard and they no longer want to be in such a difficult position. Camp management, for the record, is not about keeping people in the camps, but about helping people return to viable, secure communities or to reach their chosen durable solution. Those who left the camps up until now were among the easier to help. There were host family opportunities. For example, we have a rubble removal outfit, a heavy equipment wing. You identify an area of operations with the population of your camp. You go, you remove the rubble. Get other NGO partners, find transitional or permanent shelters or repair shelters, and then offer opportunities for those families in camp to move back into those neighborhoods. Those options have been largely exercised, and what remains in the camps today are those in the most desperate of circumstances, those who have no alternative. There's no shortcut in Haiti. I'll give an example. To date, in Port-au-Prince, temporary shelters erected number about 7,000. That's in a year. What is needed to get all of these families back into, at minimally, hurricane-resistant structures, homes that are not on tarps, on mud banks, on top, and flood zones, on top of each other, where one match could light the whole camp on fire, where disease, infections can spread like lightning. So where you had as many as 1.8 million at one point coming down dramatically to 1.2 and now at about 750,000, but now going to be the slow part. Now it's going to be the tough part. 7,000 shelters were erected. 400,000 is what would be needed. Given that the shelters themselves are all single level, they will not spread in the areas available. And so this goes back to decentralization, which is going to be mandatory to make this country work again. So all of the things, whatever happens in Port-au-Prince and whatever happens with the international community, is going to have to be complemented by business interests and aid diversifying into other areas, supporting the cities outside of Port-au-Prince and the remote areas, and, of course, agricultural interests. There's got to be more rubble removed, more shelter and housing solutions, more water and toilets, roads, hospitals, schools, jobs. We've got to offer them a way out of the camps. Landowners are getting increasingly frustrated, and most camps are on private lands. We cannot allow forced evictions, putting people from harsh into even more harsh conditions. So we must show a change of pace to landowners. According to the most recent IOM report on displacement, the number of internally displaced persons is still at 810,000, which includes 750,000 people still living in camps. People still living in IDP camps are doing so because they have no alternative. No one wants to live in an IDP camp longer than necessary, but we have to allow them to return to communities that are safe, secure, and stable. The people of Haiti deserve a Haiti that is better than it was before, and it will take time, funding, and resources. If forced evictions and relocations are condoned by the international community and the Haitian government, we will see camps moved from private lands into the streets of Port-au-Prince, which I think is something we can all agree is a worse circumstance. The time for action is now because Haiti cannot wait any longer. We cannot let the sense of optimism and belief that Haiti can recover and transform into a self-sustaining nation fade out of impatience, frustration, or complacency. We can do this right, and we owe the people of Haiti to do so. Now, one of the other issues that I have observed is that there are competing cultures of sustainable development and emergency relief. So I think that notwithstanding a Haitian perspective or an answer that would be easily picked up on by the media from a Haitian spokesperson in the relief community. We ourselves, as American citizens, have to ask ourselves, when we say that for children of a certain age, that nutrition that applies to brain function, meaning permanent, long-lasting brain function capacity, when it's not just about how much food, but what food, as that would apply to in Haiti, this is an emergency. So we're not past an emergency phase. This is one among many emergencies, shelter, cholera. Emergency and sustainable development should not be competing cultures of aid. They have to work interlinked and long-term. Once upon a time, the United States was known for its capacity to take on complete visionary projects, the Hoover Dam, and with Canada, the St. Lawrence Seaway, with its dividend linking the Great Lakes to the Atlantic. There was FDR's Tennessee Valley Authority, bringing electricity to the South. It was a rote fashion that demonstrated who we are as a people. When our First Lady Michelle Obama experienced widespread criticism and exclaiming first-time pride in our country, the criticism was wildly opportunistic, because as beneficiaries of those great generations with their bold American endeavors, we all shared the hunger and need for the return of that, our nation's dignity, not only internally, but globally. Winston Churchill said of the Marshall Plan that it was the most unsordid act in world history. And it is just such an act that is the opportunity we have in Haiti today. A reborn Haiti will spark a new generation of might, American might, through dignity. Haiti is our most impoverished neighbor, and it's a 1 hour and a half flight from Miami Beach. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thanks for this opportunity today. It's obviously an appropriate time to do a stock-taking of what's been going on in Haiti in the last year. Think about the events over the last year and the relief efforts. From USAID's side, we'd also like to think about the year going forward. I think Haiti is obviously at a pivotal moment, as Sean Penn said, right now. Sometime this year, we hope to have a new government, and I'll talk a little bit about the elections in a second. We've had the cholera epidemic has been all-consuming for the last few months, and the epidemiologists tell us that the natural curve of that is that it will lessen over this year. And there's also been an enormous analytical effort to undertake designs of new reconstruction programs. So 2011 should see reconstruction start to begin apace in Haiti. We have to get through some significant challenges, but we are at a pivotal moment. I think some of the groundwork for that pivotal moment has been laid with some of the successes that we've seen over the last year. As a development agency, we know that success ultimately depends upon the capacity of the local government and the local people. We can respond to immediate issues, but sustaining them, carrying them forward is ultimately an issue of local capacity. You know, you need a government that's committed. You need a government that's committed to make the difficult decisions and the trade-offs that it takes to propel development. You need strong institutions of government that can deliver services, respond to citizen needs, and you need markets that function so that they can allocate resources and people can invest and jobs can be created. If you think about Haiti at 9 o'clock in the morning on January 12, 2010, they would score low on any of those criteria. So the challenges that Haiti faced pre-earthquake were overwhelming challenges. Obviously, at 4:53 on January 12, those challenges were made considerably more severe in terms of having institutions of government that were strong, even having the people, as Sean Penn said, to respond to those issues. Nonetheless, I do think it is important to recognize some of the challenges. The last year of Haiti has been a tragedy upon a tragedy upon a tragedy, but there have been some things that where we can look back and think that some things did go right. You think, again, immediately after the earthquake, with large numbers of people displaced, the largest urban displacement in history. Initially 1.8 million people, the number has moved over time, but the international community's immediate fear was widespread disease, dengue, malaria, all sorts of diseases. There was a tremendous international effort to vaccinate 1 million people, to distribute 800,000 mosquito nets, and that effort has largely been successful. We have not seen an outbreak of any of those diseases in Haiti. We were also tremendously worried about the hurricanes. When you've had the largest displaced people ever in an urban setting in an island that's subject to natural disasters and hurricanes, that was an overwhelming fear. There was, again, an enormous international effort of tens and tens of millions of dollars to put in mitigation efforts to deal with to prepare for the hurricane. That included things like clearing 9 kilometers of canals that were filled with debris that every year flood and kill thousands and thousands of Haitians. It included stabilizing slopes around the camps and building drainage ditches and retaining walls and sandbags and all sorts of engineering fixes. There were 21 people who died when Hurricane Tomas went through, and that obviously is 21 deaths or 21 too many. But if you think about 2008, when Haiti was subjected to a series of tropical storms, not even a hurricane, several of them in a 2-week period, they had over 1,000 deaths. So there is some success to talk about. And we've seen the Haitian government take leadership in those areas. It was the Department of Civil Protection that did try and that had over 100 people out on the streets after Hurricane Tomas leading the effort to assess the damage and coordinate international relief. And the resilience of the Haitian people is just extraordinary. Many of you, I'm sure, have traveled to Haiti, and their ability to suffer all of these tragedies and continue going on. I think we talk a lot about the search and rescue effort that the international community led, which, again, was the largest search and rescue effort in history. Haiti, unfortunately, gives us a lot of firsts, none of which are positive. But most of the people who were saved in Haiti were saved by Haitians. The Haitians dug their own family and friends and countrymen out of the rubble, and they've continued to show tremendous resilience in the face of extraordinary challenges. Challenges going forward, they are numerous. The elections is obviously a critical challenge because you have to have a government partner that can coordinate, lead development, and that you can work with to build up sustainability. We know even before the elections were finished, the opposition claimed fraud. And some of the quick counts that were done and NGOs that were involved in it pointed to serious irregularities right away. So the United States was very supportive of the international effort to send in teams to assess this. And President Preval ultimately did request a mission from the OAS to look at this. They sent in an international team that included people from the hemisphere as well as Europeans. The goal is obviously to have an election that reflects the will of the Haitian people. So our focus is always on the process. What is a process that reflects the will of the Haitian people and can confer legitimacy on a new government? So we did support the mission that went in to do a statistical analysis. The report is, there's lots of media reports today about what the report says. None of us, as far as I know, have seen the official report. We understand that it does point to irregularities, but we're very anxious to see the report. It's expected to be given to President Preval and the Electoral Council today, we believe. And sometime in the coming week, it's expected to be given to the Permanent Council of the OAS. So the United States government will look very closely at the report and see what kinds of recommendations we can support. Again, focused on the issue of an election that reflects the will of the Haitian people and results in a government that has the legitimacy of the Haitian people. The result is obviously in part a political process because whatever happens has to be agreed to by the parties moving forward so that we don't see instability and disruption in Haiti. We know that instability is never something good for development, and our primary concern is moving forward in a way that deals with the underlying problems of poverty in Haiti. Other challenges, I think Sean Penn has mentioned a number of them, rubble removal. Rubble has been the thorn around everyone's neck. It's difficult in a country that has 80% of the land area is a slope, simply finding places to dispose of the rubble. People who've traveled there know that after much of the rubble was taken from the main roads, the back roads that are winding and narrow and are not easily accessible to large-scale equipment, it's an overwhelming, enormous challenge. But we have to move forward on that. I mean, we know through our efforts that we've removed about 1.3 million cubic meters of rubble, but we don't even know how much rubble there is. There have been estimates all over. The Army Corps of Engineers early on said 19 million. There have been subsequent engineering estimates saying 25 million cubic meters of rubble, which would be enough filling trucks bumper to bumper to go halfway around the globe. Fortunately, some recent studies we've seen say maybe there's only 10 million cubic meters left, but in Haiti we all know that finding precise data is always a challenge. So we've got to, regardless of what the total figure is, we have to accelerate and move forward with efforts to remove the rubble. That will be a significant impediment to anything. Housing, which is obviously related to the rubble. You have to clear the rubble to erect housing. It is priority number one to resettle people into a dignified life. That's our focus as for USAID, for the U.S. government, and I know that's true for much of the international community. It's difficult doing that, but that has to be the focus, getting people resettled out of the camps into lives where they can live with dignity. Our numbers are a little bit different. I mean, as far as we can count through the international community, there have been 26,000 temporary shelters constructed, which would be sufficient to house over 200,000 people. We do know that since June, the number of displaced in the camps has dropped from about 1.3 million to under 1 million. That's a significant accomplishment. It's not enough. Obviously, 800,000 or a million, whatever the number is, people living in those kinds of conditions is untenable and unacceptable for the international community. in any other disaster, if you removed, if you resettled 200, 300,000 people, it would be an extraordinary achievement. Where you have more than a million people displaced, you can hardly see that if you're at ground level in the visual. So there's a lot of work to be done. Cholera is another enormous challenge going forward. As I said, it's consumed efforts for the last few months. Cholera, I think most people know, started in the Artibonite Central Valley of the country. It fortunately didn't start in the camps, which was one of the fears, and we do think that the efforts to distribute clean water were successful in preventing those kinds of diseases in the camps. But cholera is, the medical people know better than I, it's the deadliest form of diarrheal diseases, and in an environment without proper public infrastructure for water, it spreads like wildfire. And Haiti is unfortunately a terrible place if you add cholera into the mix. So the international community has thrown lots and lots of resources at it. We still have over 3,600 deaths since October 22nd. So the disease on its own will start to decline, but we need to continue filling the pipeline for commodities as much as we can. The cholera, again, it's a tragedy for the deaths. It's a tragedy because it diverts resources from other things to try and make lasting improvements in people's lives. We will continue to focus on both prevention, which is providing clean water, providing hygiene messages, providing commodities so people can engage in normal hygiene activities, and that will reduce the number of cases, obviously, intended to reduce the number of cases, and treatment through the various treatment options of oral rehydration therapy and intravenous therapy for more severe cases to reduce the number of deaths. But that will be a challenge going forward. Overcoming the challenges is going to be difficult in Haiti, given the conditions there. What can we do about it? One of the things that we know that you have to do is you have to shift as quickly as you can to using local resources, using private resources. So we started in the early days with general food distribution, and we tried to shift as quickly as possible to, rather than giving out food, handing out cash vouchers and buying food locally, you hand out cash vouchers so people can buy it locally, and that stimulates the local economy. If you keep flooding poor countries with food, then farmers don't have an incentive to grow. So we tried to shift early on to supporting those local solutions. The same thing with water provision. Haiti has a system, a private sector system of water provision in the cities that functions. So we tried to build into that system instead of providing water because you want to strengthen local systems. Innovation is another thing that we have to continue to look at. The extent of the challenges in Haiti requires new thinking to overcome them. There's no question. And we don't have all the answers. The types of things we've looked at are providing mobile money. We're doing a joint program with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation where we've set aside cash prizes to cell phone and operators and banks who can provide a functioning mobile money system. Haiti's a country where over 80% of the people have never had access to a bank account, have never walked into a bank. If you're in that kind of situation, it's almost impossible to get out of poverty. So providing access to financial services through new technologies is something critical, and we're hopeful to announce today the giving of a prize for setting up a mobile money system. Agriculture as well. 66% of the Haitian population are engaged in agriculture. If you spend your time in Port-au-Prince, you don't necessarily see it, but it's fundamentally an agricultural economy, and poverty there is fundamentally agriculturally based. So how do you get people out of poverty in agriculture? You have to look at new technologies, new seeds, new fertilizers. And since the earthquake, we've had some programs where we've seen with targeted technical assistance, new seed varieties, you can increase productivity by 75 to 100%. When you're starting from a low base, it's not that difficult, but in the lives of poor people, it makes an enormous difference to double their income. So we need to look at those kinds of solutions and expand them. Ultimately, we'll have to continue building local capacity. We'll have to work with a new government that hopefully will reflect the will of the people and generate investment. Foreign investment, there's always talk about foreign investment, but there's domestic investment. There are wealthy Haitians. And one of the key challenges we find in development is you can go anywhere in the world and find people who have money, even in Haiti. But where do they invest their money? Wealthy Haitians tend to invest their money in Miami or France. So we need to help the government create the conditions where the wealthy Haitians feel that it's a good investment to invest in their own country. If that happens, then you're really rocking and rolling. You're really doing something to stimulate forward investment and help Haiti propel its own future. So I know we're going to have a question and answer period, but thank you very much for this opportunity.
We're going to do a quick question and answer and just take a moment for our panelists to be mic'd. I wanted to pose a question, and we can open it up for further questions, which is a general sense of timeline here. I mean, this is one of the really difficult questions, but one that might give both donors and the American population and Haitians some sense of what are we talking about in terms of time. I mean, we're dealing with an unprecedented situation in terms of the rubble removal, for example. What do you see from the ground level as are we talking about 3 to 5 years as something where we might be able to think of Haiti as in a situation where it's out of this emergency place and into a more sustainable development phase? But before you answer that, let's go ahead and open the floor to other questions. This gentleman in the middle right here. Yes. Wait for a microphone, and please identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Mark Botsford of Botsford Global. Since day one of the earthquake, the debate about economic sustainability or emergency care has been in everybody's mind. We have started a group called Maville, which means my town. It provides community planning and development. We're partnering with the Korean government. We're talking to the U.S. government. We're trying to get the IDP out of Port-au-Prince into, you know, return back to their communities. And we think we've got everything pretty much sewed up. We're rolling out the NGOs. And
do you have a question?
The question is, what do you think about the ICRH's mandate? It's supposed to be for 18 months. Do you think it'll go out for another year?
Let's take a couple more before we come back to Sean and Paul.
Good afternoon. My name is Danny Yates. I'm a William & Mary student, and I was in Haiti on January 12, 2010, at the time of the earthquake. And ever since I returned to the U.S., I've been trying to help some of my Haitian friends, which are college students over there. And my question is, based for, I guess, higher education, 95% of the university sector is knocked out. And I know a lot of the world's attention has been on things like food and medical and shelter, but I'm trying to work with a group that's going to bring some students to historically black college here in the U.S. Of course, funding issues are a big problem. Do you have any thoughts on higher education and sort of the next generation of Haitian leaders? And that's my question. Thank you.
And let me take one more right here in the front.
Hi, I'm Adam Coons from International Relief and Development. And since the early days of the disaster, there's been a lot of discussion and rhetoric about the need for decentralization, because Port-au-Prince was much too overpopulated. And the discussion continues about the need for that, but I'd like to hear a little bit about the mechanisms, how we'll actually accomplish that rather than just hope it happens.
Great. Why don't we, you all are mic'd up, so turn back to Paul and Sean for some responses. Timeline, both general and specific on IHRC and higher education, this last question.
Yeah, the IHRC mandate, as you said, was initially for 18 months. I think a lot of people have assumed that it's going to be extended beyond 18 months, but there's no decision yet. It was created by an act of parliament of the government of Haiti with the agreement of the international community. Obviously, the elections are something that having a functioning government in place is key to so many things moving forward. We'd need some sort of act of parliament, and it's not just the presidential election that's held up. It's the parliamentary elections that are also subject to some dispute. So that's something that has to be dealt with before we can do that. My guess is that we would expect to see its mandate extended, but I can't commit to that or state. In terms of university education, education is critical. You know, I can't see who asked the question, but the higher education institutions were considerably damaged. From our side, we're committing to help reconstruct the midwifery school and the medical school. There are other donors that are going to be working on other institutions, but like anything else in Haiti, it's going to be an effort of many years. I think one of the things we need to do is bring more Haitians to the United States while those institutions are being built up. We have a commitment to bring a couple of dozen a year for higher education in the U.S., and we need to look at ways to increase that, because you're right, that's critical.
Yeah, I think that my impression of the IHRC is that it's a highly functioning group of economic academics and well-intended force of people. with an entirely unrealistic structure of, I think the meetings are about once a month for 2 hours, focusing on all proposals and thousands of pages of them to enact any kind of project plan or action plan. So at this moment, I think there could be many reasons for that. That could change, and it may well be subject to what has been perceived since even before the earthquake as the lame duck administration, and with some intention to wait till after. At the moment, it is those kinds of projects and major reconstruction projects that have made, for example, the camp management things that I was talking about remain with the appearance of being static. The options are not there. On the education level, one of the things that comes to mind immediately when that's talked about, I think, is a constitutional issue with the Haitian and the Haitian Constitution, having to do with the ability of diaspora to participate in the system in Haiti, and that with a constitutional amendment on that issue will come more incentives. And then there is the issue of decentralization, which, you know, we see in a very tangible way in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince, every day, just how necessary it is. And again, this is one of the things where, whether it be through IDB and the ministries, or it be through the IHRC project planning, the encouragement of private business, for example, an international airport in Jacmel, which is a ready-made business opportunity for so many, which has, I think, about 200 room capacity in hotels, and is a beautiful tourist destination. A hotel and an airport there, I think, would be the beginning of the kind of complementary situation to international relief organization work that would start to stimulate, the potential that Haiti has.
What I'd like to do is actually give our panelists a chance to begin their remarks. And so I'm going to ask, I believe, Sam, you're our first. I mean, you speak from the chair.
Yeah, sure.
I returned from Haiti this past Saturday after spending a week visiting some of Interaction members on the ground. We have about 100 U.S. nonprofits operating there. Many of them had been in Haiti for 20, 30 years beforehand, and at the time of the earthquake, some 3,400 staff of U.S. nonprofits were on the ground. And unfortunately, like many organizations, their lives were lost. I'm starting with the nonprofits, in a sense, because it is important to recognize that all this effort is done by people. There's a sense of, I wouldn't call it burnout, but these are very tired people. There's a tremendous burden, 12, 16-hour days, day after day, for the last year. Many organizations have rotated their infrastructure through Haiti. And in many ways, what we see here, and I'm talking just about the U.S. nonprofit community, a disaster of a magnitude that is far larger than our capacity to respond. Because the world has not built the infrastructure, whether it's in the UN system or within the NGO community around the world, to handle disasters of the magnitude of Haiti or Pakistan all happening at once. So there's a gap between our capacity and what can be done. But ultimately, Haiti is about the Haitian people. It's about a people trying to pull their lives together. It's about the ability of a family to rebuild themselves. And where nonprofits and NGOs start, just like Sean Penn's effort, is at the poorest, is an ability to help a family pull themselves up. And you start that family by family. One of the accusations that is often made of the nonprofit community is we can't get scale. To me, Haiti is an example of our community at scale. Not only did the American government give, but the American public gave. Our members received $1.3 billion from the American public. Roughly half of those resources have been spent to date in Haiti by the end of October. And the reality is actually we're tight on resources, because wisely the community divided its resources between short-term relief and long-term development. And in many ways, those short-term relief resources are drying up, and you're forced with a quandary. And it's this dilemma, these choices that are being made on the ground, that I would like to highlight today. There have been lots of sort of preambles sort of on some of the challenging of the environment, the reality of the number of people in the camps. But it comes down to small little changes. is getting a tent up to provide education. It's seeing that, say, the children's tent, learning that 90% of the people who were in education system before are now back in at school. There's school intent, and you see, say, the children trying to build 54 schools going forward. At the same time, before the earthquake, we had half the population not going to school. So returning to pre-earthquake levels is what the difference here is. It is not rebuilding a Haiti. It is building a Haiti for the first time. It's seeing a rather ingenious rubble removal project run by Catholic Relief Services. Spent time in the areas where there's no truck could go. It's all wheelbarrows. It's walking through rubble with wheelbarrows, bringing it to a site where a $6,000 grinder is being operated by a group of men. And it's all being run by a business. A businesswoman who had a business before the earthquake is now running this. There's 30 or so people involved. They are gathering the rubble from the neighborhoods, running it through this crank, turning it into small pieces of rock and sand, bagging it in sand, and then selling that to the organizations that are rebuilding houses and building temporary shelters. All the people in that enterprise are paid for by the proceeds of the sale. So you see these types of exercises replicated throughout the city. But an ability to get this many people out of camps, as everyone has said, is going to take time. Most of the resources that the American people gave to nonprofits is being spent on a tremendous burn rate of simply keeping people alive, of ensuring that water and sanitation facilities exist in camps, or ensuring that drainage is available when the rains come, that there is some degree of hope. But the challenge is, and this is the dilemma that Sean Penn pointed out, the challenge is that you have to ultimately move your attention to communities around the camps. It's that ability to have a clinic at the edge of a camp providing health services that is also now providing services to 80% of its clients being people from neighborhoods, because there's actually now less demand in this one camp from in the camp than on the outside. But the tensions are real, and this is where cholera provided a real challenge for us. You ended up, again, in the same camp with a cholera clinic being created and a significant caseload of cholera cases going through. To staff a cholera clinic, you need to staff it 24/7. You had cases coming in through the night, and unfortunately, 8 people died in this clinic. There simply wasn't the staff to be able to take trained personnel to enable that cholera clinic to stand up without closing the clinic nearby at the edge of the community. So that clinic had to close down. You got the cholera clinic up and running. Now that cholera clinic's overall workload has stabilized. You get the clinic at the edge of the camp up and running again. It's these trade-offs that are tremendously difficult for us to deal with. One of our member organizations, you know, sort of talked about Haiti as a sort of an onion. The more you peel it, the more you, in essence, each crisis makes the population cry a little bit harder. And the challenge has been not only was there an earthquake, but there were a series of emergencies after the earthquake. And my guess is there will be a series of emergencies going forward. We do not know what the political situation will bring. We do not know whether another slew of hurricanes will come through again next year. We do know, and this is one thing that is pretty clear, is that the resilience of the Haitian people, the ability of the Haitian people to rebuild, is real. When people talk about building transitional shelters, this is not someone coming in to build shelters. These are Haitian people cranking out every single day frames of wood, floors, roofs out of tin that can be bolted down so that they're safe from hurricane winds. Just of 3 different NGOs, was roughly about 500 shelters of the shelters being built every week. You see a cranking up of a capacity to produce. What slows things down is there's no land. There's hardly any space. Every piece of land, there's no clear tenure system. You have 2 or 3 landowners claiming that same piece of land, claiming the house on that land. The only way to sort that out is to have a dialogue with the community, because you don't want to rush to rebuild in the wrong way. You want to rebuild where you can rebuild effectively over time. Cash for Work And this is the cache that has, for hundreds of thousands of Haitians, is providing the removal rubble. Eventually, we'll run out. Over time, we'll see clinics moving out of camps. And I think Sean Penn put his finger on it accurately. If you move too fast, you, in essence, are stopping services for very needy people right now. There's a reality that the individuals who are left in the camps, and if we're down to about 750,000, we're down maybe about half of what they were at the peak of the earthquake. The individuals left in the camps are not the easy ones to solve. Most of the people in camps were renters. There are multi-dwelling buildings. Those multi-dwelling buildings collapsed. There is simply no land to build those buildings again. It will take time. Efforts to build outside the city have proved somewhat problematic. The challenge is that there is a clear frame under the interim commission of a general direction for the country, but there is no clear operational direction. The NGO community is committed to partner with the government, with Haiti. In many ways, having done an evaluation of the tsunami for President Clinton, we see better coordination in this disaster than during the tsunami, for example. But we need a clear vision and direction, not at simply the high direction at policy, but at the operational level. What do you do with these 50,000 people in this neighborhood? What if only a quarter of them can move back to the previous where they used to live? How do you handle enabling populations that have moved out of the city have some access to jobs when there's a pull of international aid bringing people into the city? And these dilemmas are at the heart of what has slowed down the reconstruction. It is the ability of an organization like World Vision. I visited, they're building 1,167 temporary shelters. About 6,000 people sheltered in that area. Concern Worldwide, a similar effort. Do you then build a school? And you'd negotiate with the Department of Education to build that school. When you build a school, what happens when the government doesn't have the resources for the teachers? Does the NGO then step in and pay for teachers? And it is this vacuum that we're trying to fill in some ways in terms of providing direct services, but at the same time, it is not our role to fill. The international aid community, in particular the international nonprofit community, is not the government of Haiti. We can't go in and pay for teachers over time. Ultimately, it requires a partnership, and it requires the ability of the Haitian people themselves to stand up, and that will take time. There will be people in camps a year from now, and over the next 10 years, many of the organizations that are part of Interaction will be there. And I think the best way to get a sense of the diversity and direction of our community is we've recently prepared a map. It's called the Haiti Aid Map. You can see it on our website at interaction.org. It lists where I think it's about 67 different NGOs and 500 projects are around the country. It gives you a sense of who is doing what where. That is just our piece, and it will take many other pieces to make this all come together. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. Before we turn to other panelists, I know, Sean, you have to leave. I want to thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
And good luck with all your work. We really honor it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you. Okay. We're going to continue and next hear from Beth first. Beth.
Thanks a lot. Listen, every speaker so far has mentioned internally displaced persons, and so what I'd like to do in about 5 minutes is to deepen the analysis a little bit and look at some of the particular challenges of working with IDPs in Haiti and some of the challenges that Haitian displacement poses for the humanitarian community generally. Displacement in Haiti is massive. You know, whether the numbers are 800,000 or down from 1.8 million when last summer, this is a large percentage of the population. Over 1,000 IDP sites or camps in Port-au-Prince alone. Every street corner, every empty lot is filled with makeshift tents. Actually, it's filled with pretty tattered tarps rather than tents themselves. The numbers are soft. We don't really know a lot about displacement in Haiti. IOM has done a magnificent job of trying to track the numbers, but it's hard in part because this is a dynamic, complicated situation. Not everybody living in these IDP camps lost a home in the earthquake. You know, desperately poor people do desperate things. When there's rumors that assistance is being distributed to IDPs, suddenly it becomes popular, attractive to be an IDP. And certainly people have moved into the camps from poor urban communities in hopes of accessing some kind of assistance. It's hard to imagine these camps as being a draw, but at least people have a bit of shelter. Usually they have water. In one out of five sites, they have some access to health care. But it's a dynamic population. People move in and out. In the month after the earthquake, reportedly 500,000 people moved to the countryside. We don't know what happened to those people. Anecdotally, we hear that a lot of people have come back to the capital because they didn't receive sufficient assistance. But no one is keeping track of these movements of people. Reportedly, some families keep some members in the camp in case better assistance develops there, while sending kids or relatives to live elsewhere in the communities. It's been mentioned that the number of IDPs has reportedly dropped by about half in recent months. That's a good thing, but it's also a troubling thing. Why would people leave and go back to homes that have probably not been reconstructed in a safe way? Perhaps because they saw the damages of Hurricane Thomas and the flooding and made the judgment that maybe it was better to take a chance back in those damaged buildings than to suffer another hurricane season or threats of flooding given the tarps and the tents under which they were living. There was a fear, I think, as well that cholera might hit the camps, although the evidence so far has been the camps have been less hit than other areas, simply because of the congestion of the people, or perhaps it was the election violence. It's been a truism in work with IDPs for years that in order to work with displaced people, you have to work with host communities. But it's all mixed up in Haiti. Host community, urban poor, displaced people, other people affected by hurricanes, by the earthquake. While there are some displacement-specific needs, in such a setting, the vulnerabilities and the needs are so widespread that perhaps it doesn't make sense to single out assistance to IDPs, but rather to work with larger vulnerable communities. But our humanitarian system isn't set up that way. Our wonderful humanitarian relief actors are set up to provide life-saving assistance, not to deal with structural, urban, long-term, chronic poverty. And this has also been a theme that several of the speakers have mentioned, this difference between humanitarian response and long-term development. We haven't gotten it right anywhere in the world, but I think it comes in stark relief in the case of Haiti. Solutions for displacement are needed urgently. Estimates are that about 20% of these thousands or so IDP sites in Port-au-Prince and around the country are facing the threat of forced evictions. A lot of these camps are built on private land. Of course, landowners want their land back. It's been a year. Land is a very valuable asset in Haiti. The negotiations with landlords, can you let them stay a little bit longer while we look for solutions, are labor-intensive, but they're vital to coming up with solutions. When I think about the magnitude of things to be done, number one is we need a strong Haitian government. There are decisions that need to be made, whether it's operational plans, sites for dumping rubble, decisions on which camps will become part of the new urban landscape of Port-au-Prince. Decisions need to be made by the Haitian government. But frankly, the political situation is such that a lot of government energy is directed toward the elections and the politics around that. NGOs and UN staff dealing with the government wonder, oh, I'm talking with this minister. He probably isn't going to be here in a few months. So some of the uncertainty and the fear that if the clear decisions aren't made, there will be a political vacuum which will last longer, means decisions won't be made, and so on. Last comment I'll make is that I think that what we're seeing in Haiti is the humanitarian scenario of the future. The urban nature of the disaster, the juxtaposition of a devastating natural disaster with chronic poverty, underdevelopment, poor governance, conflict, and a politically mobilized population is different. It's very different than working even with displacement refugee situations in rural Africa. It requires different skills, different kinds of coordination, and most of all, much better work between long-term development actors and humanitarian response. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much, Beth. Now, Claude.
Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me. As an Asian, was born in Haiti, raised in Haiti, and as a survivor of the earthquake, allow me to just take a minute to say thank you to those who organized this meeting this afternoon, and thanks to you who take part of your time to assist us. For me, it's a sign, a great sign of support to a country that really needs this support. I am honored to be here today with you, my fellow panelists, guests, and members of the media. I wish to thank Interaction and the Booking Institution for inviting me to sit on this panel to share my perspective of the recovery process in my country and to provide my thoughts as a citizen of Haiti and a representative of Habitat for Humanity, an organization that has worked in Haiti for more than 26 years, providing thousands of families with decent, safe, and affordable housing. Habitat is committed to Haiti for the long term and engaging with local communities and its partners to address current and long-term shelter needs. I also come to you today as a survivor of the earthquake, having managed somehow to live as the roof and walls of Habitat's former offices came down on me. For me, my fellow Haitians, and all who were impacted by the earthquake, this is not an easy time. The world anniversary alone connotes something to celebrate. We are not celebrating the earthquake. We are marking this occurrence 1 year later and taking note of what has gone well and what has not since that dreadful day. For me and millions more, this past year has offered little time to pause, reflect, and cry. We have not moved beyond the emotional impact, and I suspect we may never. But by the grace of God, the support of the local and international community, and the hard work, faith, and perseverance of the Haitian people, we will move ahead and make Haiti a better and safer place to live. My assessment of the reconstruction process in Haiti is a very mixed one. The challenges Habitat for Humanity and many NGOs have faced over the past year have been well documented. From the hurricane season, the cholera outbreak, the lack of infrastructure, the national support mechanism and systems, the post-election unrest and rubble removal, to name some of the biggest challenges. That being said, there has been progress. Interaction members have repaired water infrastructure systems, built enough latrines to reach 1.6 million people, built tens of thousands of transitional shelters for families, and incorporated income generation activities into shelter construction and rubble removal projects. The emergency response immediately after the earthquake, including the distribution of 800,000 tarps, 100,000 tents, was both an extraordinary humanitarian effort, and a noteworthy success. Habitat for Humanity and its partners, including the American Red Cross, the Catholic Relief Services, the CHF International, Care USA, Save the Children, and the Adventist Development and Relief Agency, distributed more than 21,000 emergency shelter kits, conducted 2,000 damage assessments, and constructed more than 1,000 shelters, with a goal to complete many more in the coming weeks and months. Habitat has also trained more than 500 Haitians in seismic-resistant construction techniques and hired more than 2 local workers to help in construction activities. In a nation with an unemployment rate of 60%, job opportunities are crucial part of rebuilding. Habitat is also recruiting and placing experts from the Haitian diaspora to provide community-focused technical support to help the Haitian government make critical decisions related to shelter and settlement on the program funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development through its Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, OFDA. Progress has been made, but it's clear to me today that a national comprehensive urban strategy, including resettlement and shelter, is desperately needed. Shelter is a basic human need, critical to good health, stable employment, and effective education. A failure to prioritize decent shelter in Haiti's recovery efforts will not only affect the quality of life for hundreds of thousands of Haitians, but also diminish the returns of order, long-term development investments, delaying the refounding of Haiti. The issue of land rights and land tenure must be at the core of this plan. The lack of clear land rights system today has slowed the ability of Habitat and other shelter agencies to be as responsible as possible. Land ownership was a complicated matter in Haiti before the earthquake and is more clear now because of the loss of life in the tragedy. Much of the property in Haiti lacks clear ownership. Many deaths during the earthquake have not been formally documented, making claims on land by us complicated, if not impossible. It is very difficult within the current system to have easy and clear access to land. Building permanent homes is not possible if shelter agencies do not own the land or have a long-term deed rights to property on which to build. Putting Haitians back into homes without security of tenure will put them under the same risk for evictions and above market rents that existed before the earthquake, as most people who lost their home during the earthquake were renters. Tenure security gives Haitians a reason to invest in their homes. The investment will create gross domestic product and contribute to the economy as a whole. A successful resettlement plan within the context of a broader urban strategy depends upon the work of the Haitian government and the international community to empower local communities and citizens to work together to solve land disputes and ensure security of tenure. This comprehensive urban strategy about which I speak must be led by the government and people of Haiti. That plan must take into account the availability of land and improve security of tenure, land use and environmental issues, the improved delivery of basic services, including water, sanitation, health services, and transportation, national economic development, and job creation opportunities. Some measures to reduce disaster risks input from those who have lost their homes and communities, and the needs of renters who make up the majority of the population in spontaneous resettlements. The plan must include incentives, implementation plans, and realistic timetable to transition families from the camps. To support shelter and resettlement, policymakers should focus on a community and neighborhood-based approach that enables families to fix homes that can be repaired and that were practicable plans for the reintegration of Haitians into their original neighborhoods and livelihoods. Policymakers should also address shelter needs of former renters when return to rental units is impossible. Policies of urban inclusion and support are essential to establishing fairness and equity on the ground. Priority should also be given to building the capacity of the Haitian government at the national, local, and municipal levels. It is now frequently labeled as the NGO capital of the world. This is both a commendation of the incredible outpouring of support from the United States and the international community, and a warning on the amount of work to be done in developing local Haitian capacity in all sectors, not just shelter. International non-governmental organizations will not be able to support the Haitian society indefinitely, nor should they. For Haiti to remain vibrant, stable, and prosperous long after the recovery effort, all the international NGOs must work to increase the capacity of local and municipal governments. Local NGOs, community-based organizations, and the private sector to address the daily needs and aspirations of the Haitian people. While I firmly believe in and urgently advocate for a comprehensive urban strategy, we do not have the luxury to make it a prerequisite for current projects to continue or new ones to launch. We cannot wait for a plan to be developed, but must continue to move ahead, collaborating with local municipalities, communities, partners, and donors to provide logical and effective support needed to give millions of Haitians a better life today and a brighter future tomorrow. Let today be the first day of a new opportunity to rethink approaches, to be flexible and creative in our response, and to find new ways to help Haiti recover and rebuild. Today, when I visit villages, I see families coming together, singing and playing. I see signs of hope. As Francois Carr, a local carpenter hired by Habitat for Humanity following the earthquake, said, "When you know someone cares about you, you feel less pain." Because of the global support received over the past year, people like Francois Carr and thousands of families are feeling less pain today. Let us join together once again to bring hope to many more families. I thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak. I am humbled every day by the outpouring of prayers, support, and kindness. I am thankful to be alive, and I am personally committed, along with Habitat for Humanity, to be part of Haiti Renewal today and in the weeks, months, and years to come. Thank you again.
Thank you, really, for those very moving and personal words of both thanks and looking forward to very practical solutions, and your comment in particular about how a sense of caring helps alleviate pain, I think, is one we could all take home and inspire us in the months and years ahead. Let's take some questions, and I did want to pose two thoughts, and then before coming back to the panel, we'll also go back to the room. But there are two subjects that we haven't really touched on very much, which I know are of pressing concern. One is sanitation, and Beth, in particular, I'm thinking about some notes you sent me yesterday about this. You know, it's such a difficult and tractable problem, and it involves land use, of course. Help us think about that problem. And secondly, the issue of sexual violence, particularly in the camps. You know, what's being done more generally about security around the camps? Do we have enough international presence to deal with that? Is there enough training going on of local police? I'd like to hear a little bit more about that as well. Let's take a couple of questions from the floor. I see someone in the way back, and then we'll move. Try to move forward. I see a gentleman also.
Thank you very much. My name is Amy Kokenauer. I'm with the Pan American Development Foundation, and I did want to say something about the sexual violence, gender-based violence piece in the camps. Through USAID, my organization had been implementing a human rights project over the past 3 years, and one of the things that was done immediately following the earthquake was to immediately work with our 40-plus Haitian partners, organizations, to set up monitoring committees in the camps, specifically to address the issue of protection and sexual and gender-based violence. So there are efforts going on that are spearheaded by camp leaders, camp community-based organizations to report, monitor, and try to work with local authorities on that issue, although the issue is overwhelming and a lot more work needs to be done. So one piece I wanted to ask is what USAID's strategy going forward might be related to that issue. Some of those projects are closing down, and the need remains very, very great. The only other thing I wanted to mention, sorry, my original comment was to pick up on what the colleague from Habitat was discussing. With regard to one of the achievements, I think one of the positive notes is this damage assessment piece. Working with the Ministry of Public Works, UNOPS, the Pan American Development Foundation, with funding from USAID and the World Bank, over 400,000 structures in Port-au-Prince were assessed with damage assessments that are quite detailed. And the outcome of that is now a repair strategy in the neighborhoods for yellow tagged houses, meaning homes that have received limited entry yellow tags that can be repaired at a relatively low cost. Not only that, it creates jobs in the neighborhoods, it gets people back into their homes, and also works with Haitian engineers, masons, contractors, et cetera, as well as the Ministry of Public Works. So my second piece was to get additional comments on what some people call the neighborhood approach, the neighborhood strategy. And Sam, maybe any comments you may have from your recent trip about that repair-based work. I know there are plans moving forward to increase that. In fact, we're holding a training next week.
Thank you. We have a couple of other people who want to jump in.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yes, this gentleman in the back, and then we'll move forward.
Good afternoon. How are you? I thank the entire panel. My name is Dominique Toussaint. I'm the chair of Mobilize for Haiti. And the reason that most of the NGO organizations are in Haiti is because there was a vacuum of leadership that existed right after the earthquake. People donated in mass amounts because they wanted that vacuum to be filled. They thought the solutions would come. They still are not there. What I would want to ask is specific to emergency preparedness. The rainy season is coming in a few weeks. What is being done to prepare people for that time frame? And a couple weeks later will be the start of the hurricane season. So what is being done in that space there? The final comment is, instead of focusing so much on the difficulties that exist, which is clear, you know, we've been seeing the reports for the past year, let us try to focus more on the possibilities and the solutions that can be found. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take one more over here, and this gentleman in the middle.
My name is Johnny Young. I'm with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And we have been in Haiti through Catholic Relief Services for over 50 years, and of course, will continue to be there. We helped in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, and hope and will be there for the longer term. We've talked about no quick fixes, and we certainly agree with that. But there are there remains some items that still need to be done, and I would like to ask that the U.S. government look into what more can be done in four areas. One would be in delaying the deportation of persons back to Haiti for criminal offenses. The second would be family reunification for persons who were brought to the United States in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake and now are separated from their family members who are still in Haiti. We have one case, for example.
We have little time
okay.
left. Okay, so
well, family reunification.
Give me your two more, yep.
Okay, fine. The other would be in temporary protective status for persons who came to the United States after the earthquake. And the other would be expeditious approval for those Haitians who have already been approved to immigrate to the U.S., moving them up in the queue. So those are the four areas.
Great. Thank you very much for those very specific. Let's come back to the panel for some final comments, and please respond as much as you can to these questions.
Starting with me?
Thanks. Yes, please, Paul.
I guess I'll start with the sexual violence question, which I think you know. We know that if you have a situation of large displacements, it's predictable that there are worries about sexual violence. We have, as the person who asked the question answered, we've programmed some resources to try and deal with that issue in a number of the camps. If the money's running out, as long as the camps are there, it's something that we need to seriously consider continuing to program resources for. The long-term solutions have to be with strengthening the local capacity of the social, of the welfare ministry to deal with these issues, as well as the security option. We don't, on USAID, we don't work directly with the police, but there's obviously a security dimension to this. The Haitian National Police are the organization primarily responsible. I think it's also one of the successes of the last year. I think we've seen multiple polls that show that if Haitians are asked, where do you want to get your security services from, they choose the Haitian National Police over the international community, and there's been a lot of work over the last several years, not by us, but by the international community, by the State Department principally, on strengthening the police. So we need to continue to do that to make sure that the security option is there and working. Emergency preparedness, there's been an ongoing effort for years. It was accelerated last year before the onset of the hurricane season to strengthen at the national level, Department of Civil Protection, as well as the municipal levels. It's not just Port-au-Prince. It's San Marc, Cap-Haïtien, Léogâne. There are lots of areas where we're working with local government to strengthen their capacity to prepare for and to respond to hurricanes and storms. We'll also have to take another look at the hurricane mitigation efforts that were done before the last season and to see what needs strengthening. On the range of immigration issues, I know that the Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security have been in a dialogue with elements of the Haitian diaspora, the Haitian government on those issues, and I know there's a lot under consideration. I can't speak to the specifics of those four issues.
Great. Beth, we'll just come down.
Hey, just on sexual violence, it is horrific. It is horrific, widespread. The police are barely present, sorry. When I met with the UN Protection Cluster talking about this, and I said, well, what about the police? And they said, we're trying to get phone numbers of local police stations. We're trying to get phone numbers. You know, counting as a big success that MINUSTAH's policing arm is now patrolling the most vulnerable camps. But that's one-tenth of the total camps. And by patrolling, it means driving around once or twice a month. The violence is horrific, and much more needs to be done. Sanitation is very much related to the temporary nature of some of these camps. It doesn't make sense, or it isn't possible, to construct permanent latrines or other waste disposal facilities on land that's temporary. And so these portable toilets are being used, which are very expensive to bring in, out, clean, so forth. And so long-term solutions for sanitation depend in part on coming up with a governmental policy for development.
There is a clear gender dimension to Haiti. The average Haitian household is run by a woman. It has to be a recognition of the role of gender in the Haitian context. And I won't say more than the reality is a rough one. People don't go into the camps at night. There's a degree of security in the daytime. It's at night when we have a problem. On sanitation, it's a long way to go. I'll give one very positive example. It's an interesting role for an NGO, World Vision. Every single sludge truck that drops human waste in one place that leaves that site is cleaned with chlorine to not spread cholera and other diseases. So you've got sites where you could begin to do this. But ultimately, it is not a tenable situation. The efforts on sanitation have to be in each village, which gets me to the neighborhood approach. And this was an interesting effort that we saw of Catholic Relief Services. It is an effort in a community. It is that neighborhood rebuilding itself. It is providing the materials to build a house. It is looking at the drain of water in the center of that community, and can you clean it over time so when the rain falls that there's significant place for that water to go. We are not ready for another hurricane in Haiti. If there was a direct hit, it would be a real mess. An enormous amount has been done to dredge, to move resources, but ultimately we're going to need some more secure shelters. And it comes down to this ability of Haitian institutions and Haitian neighborhoods to take some degree of control over their lives. That transition from international nonprofit to a local institution is a transition that's taking time. It is a transition that needs to take place, and I think it will happen neighborhood by neighborhood. Neighborhood development will not happen overnight. We'll be at it for years, but it is ultimately the core of any success in this effort.
I would like to make two quick comments about the 2 cent questions. For the rainy season, as an organization, Habitat for Humanity keeps building secure and safe building for the families affected. So we not only built more than 1,000, but we are planning to build almost 2,000 in the next coming months. It's a way to take people out of camps and to place them in a more safe place, a safer place. Besides of that, we are working closely with municipalities and civil protection department, where we are putting in place some local committees to identify the risky areas. If something happens, if there is flooding, for example, where to go? So we have 6 local committees all over the country. They clearly know where to go if something happens. It's the best way we can support the civil protection department, the municipalities, while we are building safer place for them. In terms of let's be focused on solutions instead of problems. As I mentioned before, the best way to do it is to empower Haitians to take them in charge instead of coming and acting on our behalf. Allow us to do some mistakes. Give us the possibility to work besides international communities, because there could not be in Haiti forever. So at a certain moment, we need to be able to take charge. So the best way to bring solutions is to empower, to transmit the knowledge, the competency we don't have now. We have so many organizations working down there, lack of leadership, as you mentioned, lack of capacity. So how long can we attract so many organizations? Let's build the capacity. Maybe if something happens in the near future, we'll be able to welcome any helper, but we have less because we got the capacity to respond directly to our problems.
Well, I think that's an appropriate note to end on. We've run out of time. Thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking the panelists.